Welcome to the first real official edition of the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes.
What were those two podcasts we did before? Those were good.
Yeah, they were sort of bonuses, weren't they?
Geez, you know, just throws the first two podcasts under the bus. I mean,
but now it's real.
Let's go ahead. You're the editor. You're the editor in chief, Charlie.
I'm the editor in chief, and you're editor at large.
I am.
Which is like the perfect title, you know.
Yeah.
And then there's Jonathan.
No real responsibility.
Jonathan Last, who is going to be the experiential director for the new Bulwark website.
Director of Special Operations.
Director of Special Operations.
I like that.
For those of you who've been wondering what was going on, today is the full launch, not just of the Bulwark podcast, but of the Bulwark website. It is fully operational. The Death Star is up, and we've assembled a real all-star cast, not just JV Last. I was told what not to call you.
So, JV Last.
Yeah,
but
JV
you've
Last.
Called me JV Last. See, I now feel like it's like our special thing.
Everybody
calls me JVL.
I actually got a call once from Jim Swift, who, by the way, is also joining us as a senior editor. He said, "You know, I don't think he likes JV Last. He goes with." And then he gave me all the different options. And of course, my brain goes back to.
But it's like our special pet name for each other.
It's our thing.
JV.
Right, nice. Chuck?
Too much information. Don't we call it that?
So we are fully operational. You can go to the website right now and see about us. We've also written a quasi-mission statement, Jonathan, that explains what we are up against, the particular
proof
moment.
Proof of concept.
The proof of concept,
maybe.
Which is
would that work?
We think we're in a moment in politics.
Yeah, I would say. We seem to be, we're certainly in a moment. And what is the future going to be like? It's not a backward-looking operation, it's a forward-looking operation. And things are going to change drastically over the course of the next 2 years. And it would be nice to have a publication which can tell you what it really thinks.
And
not believe that they have to swallow or tamp down their real thoughts, because that would be having their cake and eating it too. That they have to, you know, pretend to the world that they think something that they don't actually think. We're not going to do that. The highest duty that any writer owes to their audience is to tell people what they actually think, or wrong.
Yeah, okay, you said we're not going to look backwards. People are going to say, hey, a lot of you guys, we used to work at the Weekly Standard. We're not the Weekly Standard 2.0. This is something new. But it does strike me that the shutting down of the Weekly Standard makes it more urgent than ever to have a voice like what we're going to do with the Bulwark, which is going to be addressing the political moment we have now. We know what people say in private about the president. We know what they are willing to write in anonymous op-ed pieces. But I think we're dedicated to the proposition that, you know, now it's time to use your outside voice to be able to talk about that. You know, William F. Buckley Jr., when he founded National Review, said that the role of conservatives has been quoted too much, but, you know, was to stand athwart history and shout stop. I think the role of the Bulwark will be to stand athwart what's going on now and going, are you serious?
You're right.
Seriously? Are you really going to go along with this?
But also show people maybe a path forward. Look, I think I'm very excited about it. It'll be the Bulwark has been going for a couple of months as an aggregator, a very useful one, I think, actually, of interesting things to read about our current political situation, especially with a focus on the Republican Party, conservatism, President Trump, implications for the future. And now we'll have original content as well as aggregated links. So I think it'll be a real one-stop shopping for people who care about the future of conservatism, the Republican Party, Trump's. Could Trump be primaried? Could he be challenged? Will Republicans finally split from Trump? What's the future of conservatism after Trump? Some, you know, we'll be linking to big idea pieces, but also to very day-to-day, you know, what's happening in New Hampshire and what are the maneuverings at the Republican National Committee. So I think it'll be I hope it's a place people go in the morning and then a couple of other times during the day. I think the original content, you guys have done a great job of lining up a bunch of contributors. We'll see. The proof will be in the eating of the pudding, so we shouldn't overhype it here in the very first morning of the full new Bulwark. But I'm thrilled to be associated with it and happy that you guys are doing all the serious work.
So, Jonathan, when we're talking about, you know, what we're all about here, I put one of the questions people are going to have is, you know, is there an audience for, quote unquote, and I'm using this as shorthand, never Trump conservatives? Now you can push back on the never Trump thing because I don't know what it means, but I mean that, you know, is there a market for all of this? I mean, isn't the conventional wisdom is so kind of settled in that it's just, you know, a few conservatives out there who are completely irrelevant and out of touch? So, are we testing the proposition that there are people who would like to hear a contrarian view from the center right center?
Yeah, I mean, I think the midterm elections tested that proposition, and the results were pretty resounding, right? It turns out there are a giant, huge pool of millions and millions of conservative-leaning Americans who simply will not go along with Trumpism as it is currently configured. And they are actual real people with actual real jobs and opinions of voters. And the idea that they don't count somehow and that they are not real conservatives is crazy. I mean, just literally just a crazy thing.
Yeah, the trajectory is not good. I mean, Donald Trump loses the popular vote in 2016 by 3 million votes. Republicans lose the popular vote by, what, more than 8 million votes?
8 million in the House
vote,
yeah.
Look at the trend line.
Now, Trumpism has not created an electoral majority yet. I mean, this is, you know, if you think that the election of Donald Trump was a black swan type event, which is to say that if you rerun the election 10 times, he wins it twice or something like that, which I think is about what it was. I mean, I think if you sort of just as a political science analytical matter look at it, it's a total of 70,000 votes distributed across three states. It is the electoral equivalent of having drawn to an inside straight, not even an outside straight, but an inside straight. Now, that's a real thing, and it's impressive in its own way and all of that. And even black swan events like that create real facts on the ground going forward. It doesn't mean that they exist in unreality. But that said, has Trumpism looked ascendant to you over the last 2 years? It hasn't to me. I mean, it's looked like a series of unfortunate events where it careens from one problem to the next. It is striking to me when you
more shrill.
Yeah, when you
dominant.
When you look at the band of the president's approval rating over the course of his first 2 years in office. He spent the entire 2 years within a zone of 8 points. His highest approval rating was 44%, which he touched only for like 3 days total in 2 years. His lowest was 36%, which he touched more than a few times. If you look historically at almost every other president since the advent of TV and politics, you see a much, much wider dispersal of approval ratings. I mean, he is locked in. And that is not what an ascendant ideology looks like.
Yeah. And whether it's a senator or not, I mean, I think I would come back to the spirit of Bill Buckley when he started National Review, which is they had no prospects of winning anything in the very near future. But they thought it was the right thing to do. And you never know what's going to happen. And you got to make the case. I actually do think there's a real prospect of defeating Trumpism in the Republican Party and the conservative movement for the electoral reasons Jonathan mentioned. And just because ultimately it's incoherent, it's not going to work. And let's see what happens over the next year or two in terms of the economy and foreign policy. But you see the administration already staggering downhill. I think that's very striking in the last 2 or 3 months, even going from having people in there whom one could respect and who were keeping things somewhat on track to
almost all those grown-ups are gone now.
Yeah, yeah. So your second and third team and a lot of sycophants and stuff. So I think electorally it's problematic. In terms of real results, it's problematic. In terms of what we, I think, believe in generally, in terms of conservatism and the importance of character and American leadership around the world and limited government and all kinds of things, it's very problematic. So I don't know if we're going to win or not, but I think Buckley said this in the founding statement of National Review. We'll have a good time doing it and make the case unapologetically. I think what Jonathan said earlier is very important. So many people on the right, and you know this, Charlie, you've written about this, are pulling their punches, mm-hmm. not really saying what they believe. Fatalistic. Maybe in 8 years we'll get beyond Trump. Meanwhile, we just have to keep our heads down. And that's certainly not the attitude we're going to take at the Bulwark.
No, and the other thing is, I was just talking with somebody the other day who was saying, so what do you think the Republican Party is going to look like post-Trump? And the answer is, we don't know. It's not just going to snap back. It's not going to simply return to what it was before. And there are a lot of things that have been revealed and that have been exposed that we're going to have to cope with for a long time. I mean, it's like we turned over a rock, and the lizard people now think that they are running the world, our new insect overlords. So I think, you know, part of it is dealing with what's happened to the conservative movement. I've said this before. Look, Donald Trump is Donald Trump. He does what he does. He is exactly who you expected he would be. But the corruption of the conservative movement, as we see our friends, our colleagues, people we used to think we were allied to, you know, changing their view and not just pulling their punches, but beginning to reevaluate, you know, their standards of character. And when I said before, it's become more shrill rather than dominant. You do get the sense, and I'm used to having my soul crushed on all of this, that there is a, you know, that Trumpism is experiencing a crisis, and you can see it by the almost hysterical sorts of defenses that are being launched. You know, Mitt Romney comes out with that that op-ed piece. You know, Ari Fleischer needs to rip on him. The usual folks need to, you know, attack him. Op-ed piece by Henry Olson in the Washington Post that basically says this is how out of touch you people are because you actually think that character is more important than delivering tax cuts. I mean, that just strikes me as sort of the end stages of a certain intellectual corruption.
Yeah, I think that's right. But and the question then is where to go. And I think it does require fresh thinking. That's the other reason I'm so pleased to be associated with the Bulwark. And, you know, it's time for some fresh thinking on a whole bunch of issues. We've all tried to do it in our past lives and whatever publications we were with or on radio and the books you've written, Charlie. But, you know, it's a new moment economically. The economy's changed a lot. High tech, big tech, high tech, and the communications revolution. The world is different than it was during the Cold War or even for the 20 years or so after. So, you know, I hope the Bulwark features a lot or calls attention to a lot of this fresh thinking that is necessary. You can't pretend Trump didn't happen. You can't pretend that the world is exactly what it was. And certainly when Reagan was president or even when George W. Bush was president or Mitt Romney ran in 2012.
Well, what I've said this to you, Jonathan. I think our timing's pretty good here because the next 3 or 4 months is going to be extraordinary.
It's going to be a lot of news.
Yeah, what do you think? So we got, what do we have? We have confirmation hearings for Secretary of Defense, Senator, Attorney General, a Mueller report. We'll see what happens with the markets, which have been extremely rocky and might herald economic issues and problems with a huge deficit, incidentally. So if we do go into slip into recession, there's not much latitude in terms of fiscal policy.
And then you have just Donald Trump's character.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think that's worth asking is what is the greatest threat to Trumpism? Is it, you know, is it the Mueller report? Is it you know, Democrat oversight? Is it the economy? Which of these things is it? I would say that that if you're Donald Trump, because he's not, you know, burdened with a lot of self awareness, I'm guessing he's worried about the economy. And so, what do you? I mean, think do the always Trumpers? Is there erosion? I mean, is part of it buoyed by the fact that they're feeling good about themselves? The stock market is up. The economy. What happens to Trumpism if the economy goes down? Can he pull it off and blame it on Nancy Pelosi? Would that work? He'll try.
I think it. Well, sure, he'll try. I mean, he could try to fire Jay Powell, right? I mean, this is a. I mean, if you look at the sort of, you know, potential landmines out there, you can just imagine what would happen to the markets then. So the good faith version of Trumpism was that Trump was Reagan, that the elites were so out of touch with where the country was, that he was going to come in the same way that Reagan came in and reformed the Republican Party, and that once people saw the real Trump and saw the fruits of his administration, that everybody would get on board. And reality has not been that. Reality has been that he came in, as Denny Green said, he was who we thought he was. Right. And people have seen it, and they don't like it. As I said, that narrow band, and even with the first 2 years where the economy was as good as it could possibly be, foreign affairs were as good as they could possibly be, he couldn't crack even 45% in presidential approval. It is going to be very, very hard. And I think the reason people reacted so violently to like the Romney op-ed is because they sense the weakness inherent. If he was politically strong, then people would look. First of all, there would be no market for politicians to begin like probing and thinking about whether or not to challenge in 2020. And two, the Trump partisans would not care, right? I mean, they would look at this and say, well, fine. It's, you know, nobody's going to primary us because we're too strong.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is, like, last week at that cabinet meeting, you know, people, I don't care what your politics were, you watched this and you saw the president, you know, ranting and doing behaving that particular way. It had to alarm you, particularly if you realize that your political legacy is going to be tied to his. And we've seen an almost bottomless willingness to compromise with him, to enable him, to capitulate to him. But and of course, this is the question people have been asking: what is the breaking point? I do think you mentioned the firing of Jay Powell. This is a president who is not only unhinged, but he's untethered and is capable of anything. It's certainly possible that the Democrats could decide internally that they will not they won't go ahead with impeachment, but they will have no choice if the president, you know, actually fires Robert Mueller. If Robert Mueller were to indict Donald Jr., I could see him lashing out. He has no inherent you know, core sense of the limitations of what he can do, and he surrounded himself with a group of really, you know, second and third rate sycophants like the fake attorney general. So this is not going to get any better for Donald Trump. And it's not going to get any better for the people who are making apologies for him.
Yeah, and this is where character matters. I mean, it matters in government.
Judgment.
And it matters in governing. At some point, James Mattis just decides, I can't put up with this anymore. He had hoped to stay 4 years. I talked to people who are very, very close to Mattis. I know him slightly, but I haven't talked to him in quite a while. But he wanted to stay. He thought he was doing good for the country by being there. They were accomplishing some things, the defense buildup. But maybe as important or more important, he was stopping certain things from happening. Obviously, he had the standing to stand up to the president. And at some point, he just decided going forward, Trump was being less and less responsible, more and more impulsive, more and more going with what his, you know, gut, as Trump likes to put it, told him in Syria and in Afghanistan and elsewhere, and picking the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, where he ignored the Secretary of Defense's recommendation. And I think that's why it doesn't get better for Trump. It gets worse. He is who he is, and it's pretty hard to overcome that. And he felt somewhat constrained in the first year, year and a half, and those constraints have been going away. Well, now, having said all that, we shouldn't be too gloomy. And
No. Because things do matter. For example, you know, that cliche that nothing matters. But when somebody like General Mattis makes that decision and the president finds himself under attack by all of these other generals, American heroes, whose patriotism cannot be questioned. You know, going back to, remember George Conway, Kellyanne Conway's husband, one of the turning points for him was the firing of FBI Director Jim Comey. And that he was willing to go along with this. He was there at election night. He was supporting Donald Trump for president, was considering a position in the Department of Justice. And then that event basically made him step back and go, whoa, you know, what have I done? What am I part of? Where is this guy going? And that's been one of the stories. So, you know, are there other George Conways in less complicated circumstances who can be broken off by doing this sort of thing? So, you know, one of the things we're going to do, I think, at the Bulwark, and we've talked about this rather extensively as in the run-up to all of this, is that I do think that we need to take on the people who have been most responsible for polluting the stream of intellectual character, to push back against some of the faux intellectuals who, you know, always will provide the air cover or the tortured justifications for some of the things that he has done. I think was your phrase, Jonathan, that we are going to be the antimatter to certain publications that we don't need to elevate. But,
well, I mean,
unless you want to.
What we're going to do is we're going to tell people what we really think. I mean, this is what I would emphasize is that, you know, it may sound like we're talking deterministically about what the next 2 years are going to be, but I really believe that there is an unbelievably wide range of possible outcomes. You know, I mean, we could have everything from a Trump re-election to a Trump impeachment but non-conviction to a Trump resignation. I mean, it is as wide open as since, like, things were really bad for Johnson towards the end of his term. And so we're going to look at all of this stuff and be smart about it and tell you what we actually think. And I don't know that this is all anybody wants from anything they read and all any of their points of analysis to get people who are not cheerleading, who are not trying to cover or play some quadruple bank shot or five-dimensional chess, but who will look at what's going on and tell you what they actually believe is happening.
So, and one of the goals of the podcast, you know, this is in some ways for me, it is a continuation of the Daily Standard podcast because that's what we did, and we generally had, you know, staffers from the magazine on. We will, of course, be talking to the staffers of the Bulwark, but I think one of the mission statements for the podcast is to broaden that out and to find a forum for a lot of the most interesting voices here in Washington and around the country on the conservative movement who are thinking through, either thinking through the near-term political calculations or longer-term, what does it mean to be a Republican? What does it mean to be a conservative? What direction should we take? So we're going to have, I think we have lined up a rather extraordinary and diverse, and I'm hoping somewhat unexpected, list of guests.
I'm sure you have, and I look forward to listening to each of the podcasts and reading the material each day and maybe contributing occasionally. And I think there'll be differences among us. We don't all agree on everything, and certainly analytically, it's hard to know, as Jonathan said, where we're going. So no one would be an idiot to say, well, we have certainty about this or that. But I think having an honest discussion of the current moment, the likely futures that are the possible futures, the likely futures if we do nothing, the alternatives that are ahead, I hope we can really provide a service by doing that, and I'm looking forward to being part of it.
And Jonathan Last will be the kid sitting at the back of the classroom making fun of the kids, you know, the geeks at the front of the classroom. That is you. Well, thank you for listening to the first official Bulwark podcast. I hope we make this daily, but I'm not going to make a promise about that. We'll be back tomorrow. I'm Charlie Sykes.